Genesis 2, the third talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on March 5, 2000 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
For those of you that still have Bibles, we'll be looking at Genesis chapter 2. The last 2 weeks I talked about Genesis chapter 1, and what I argued is that what we find in Genesis chapter 1 is a very stylized account, that it's, if you read it, it reads differently from the rest of Genesis. It's a different genre. And in that section, what we have is a description of what God did to make the universe and to make the universe a place for man to live. So in that first chapter, the things that are highlighted is man's place in the universe, and that is he is the last act of creation. He was the thing for which everything else led up to. And we have God depicted as the one who created everything. So we have our two main characters that we find in Genesis, God and man, and both of them are introduced and they are put in their places. Chapter 2 then changes. In chapter 2 we're going to talk about creation again, but we're going to talk about it from a different perspective. It's kind of zooming in on man himself and how he was created. And in particular, what we're going to see in chapter 2 is an emphasis on how God provided for man. Let's read through the account, and then I will give my running narrative. So starting with verse 4. This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created, in the day that the Lord God made earth and heaven. Now no shrub of the field was yet in the earth, and no plant of the field had yet sprouted. For the Lord God had not sent rain upon the earth, and there was no man to cultivate the ground. But a mist, or a flow, it could be translated, used to rise from the earth and water the whole surface of the ground. Then the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And man became a living being. And the Lord God planted a garden toward the east in Eden. And there he placed the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground the Lord God caused to grow every tree that is pleasing to the sight and good for food. And the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it divided and became four rivers. And the name of the first is Pishon. It flows around the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. And the gold of that land is good. The bdellium and the onyx stone are there. And the name of the second river is the Gihon. It flows around the whole land of Cush. And the name of the third river is Tigris. It flows east of Assyria. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. Then the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, "From any tree of the garden you may eat freely, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it you shall surely die." Then the Lord God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him." And out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called a living creature, that was its name. And the man gave names to all the cattle, and to the birds of the sky, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found a helper suitable for him. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. Then he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh at that place. And the Lord God fashioned into a woman the rib which he had taken from the man and brought her to the man. And the man said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." I think my understanding of this account is that Moses has talked about how the universe was created, and now he wants to really focus in, zoom in on man, and explain how man came to be, man both male and female, and the kinds of provisions that God made for man on this earth. So he starts out, we're going back then and looking at the creative activity again, and he's going back to the time when apparently there were not many plants. Now the way I put this together is, it says there was no rain and there was no man to cultivate the ground. Apparently the thinking of Moses is that but there is water, and it comes apparently from flows up from under the ground. Some translations say mist, but more recent linguistic data seems to point in the direction of flows. So water's coming up from under the ground, and there are rivers, obviously. So water is being carried along the ground by rivers. But water doesn't make it from the rivers to the rest of the ground. We have rain. And rain is what carries the water to the rest of the ground, and therefore we have vegetation most everywhere. But at this time, apparently, there was no rain to spread that water elsewhere, nor was there man to spread that water artificially through irrigation. So we've got rivers, and the banks of rivers presumably would be a place where plants can grow. But the rest of the dry ground is very dry and arid. So in the account it says there was no shrub of the field was yet in the earth, and no plant of the field had yet sprouted. The shrub of the earth, the term there is a word describing a bush that grows in the desert. So there weren't even any desert plants yet at this time. So he's describing a time when, if you look out at the earth, for the most part, it's dry ground. It's like desert. It's very arid. There are only places where the rivers are running that there is water that could irrigate plants, and plants could grow. This was the state of things then when God decided to create man. He creates man through a special act. We have much more description here of him creating man than anything else. The way that he creates it is interesting. It's from the dust of the earth. He takes the dust of the earth and he fashions it into a man, and then he breathes the breath of life into him. The dust of the earth here, you just mix that with water and you've got clay. So then the word that's used for fashion is the same word that's used for a potter who is fashioning a pot. So man is essentially a glorified pot that was handcrafted by God. But he's nothing more significant in a sense. He's just a pot. And that is a image that's drawn upon elsewhere, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, that we are likened to clay pots. However, there is something different, and that is God breathed into man the breath of life. having the breath of life is not unique to man. The animals are described as having the breath of life. It says that man was made a living being. That too is not unique to man. The animals are referred to as living beings. The only thing that's unique here is that God himself breathes the breath of life into man. That's the only thing that's distinctive here about the description of man coming into existence. So again, it's similar to what we had in chapter 1 of Genesis, in which on the sixth day, God did two different things. The first thing he did on the sixth day was to create the animals. The second thing he did on the sixth day was to create man. So there's a sense in which man is very much like the animals. But as we saw in the first chapter, the thing that makes man different is that man was made in the image of God. There is something godlike about man. Man is this strange hybrid, kind of like the animals, and yet there's a hint of the divine in him. There's a bit of the divine there. And here, man is described as nothing more than a clay pot. He is much like the animals, the only difference being God breathed the breath of life into him. So again, a hint of the divine. Having made man then, God put him in a place that had been specially prepared for man, a place that's unique, a paradise that God has created in this otherwise desolate landscape. He has picked a place where he has caused all kinds of plants to grow. It's a place that is well watered. He puts all kinds of trees that are pleasing to the eye, trees that are good for food. So these are all, he doesn't mention poison oak. He's talking about things that are good things that are placed in this garden. And there are two trees that he singles out for mention that are placed in the middle of the garden. The tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Strange names for trees. We're more used to something like Gravenstein or Macintosh. We're going to talk about this more later, but it is interesting that he chose meaningful names for these trees. These are names that Adam could reflect upon and speculate as to why these trees have this name. But having introduced these trees, Moses just moves on. He abandons that and just moves on, leaves us in suspense as to why those trees are mentioned at all. This garden-like area is unique in that it is well watered. We have four different rivers that either come together here or flow out from here. It's a little bit difficult to put this together. Two of the rivers are well known, the Tigris and the Euphrates. The other two are not, it's not clear what rivers those might be. And we'll talk about where this could be in just a second. But in any case, this is a well-watered place as opposed to the rest of the earth that is, for the most part, arid at this time. There is a list of desirable resources that are located in this area. It mentions gold, and the gold was very good. Bdellium, onyx. Things that are desirable to man and make this a good place. Look, there are other times in the Old Testament when things are likened to this garden. Just Let's turn to Ezekiel 31 briefly. Just look at the description there. This is not the only place in the Old Testament where an area is likened to the Garden of Eden or the Garden of the Lord. But this is the this is a speech that's made to the Pharaoh of Egypt about what happened to Assyria. And so this land this description is a description of what Assyria was like before God devastated it. Starting in middle of verse 2. Whom are you like in your greatness? Behold, Assyria was a cedar in Lebanon, with beautiful branches and forest shade, and very high, and its top was among the clouds. The waters made it grow. The deep made it high. With its rivers, it continually extended all around its planting place, and it sent out its channels to all the trees of the field. Therefore, its height was loftier than all the trees of the field, and its boughs became many and its branches long, because of many waters as it spread them out. All the birds of the heavens nested in its boughs, and under its branches all the birds of the field gave birth, and all great nations lived under its shade. So it was beautiful in its greatness, in the length of its branches, for its roots extended to many waters. The cedars in God's garden could not match it. The cypress could not compare with its boughs, and the plane trees could not match its branches. No tree in God's garden could compare with it in its beauty. I made it beautiful with the multitude of its branches, and all the trees of Eden, which were in the garden of God, were jealous of it. That is not the passage that I thought it was. There's another one where it likens it. It talks about all of the same minerals that are present in the land that are the same as in the Garden of Eden. But in any case, what we see in a number of passages in the Old Testament is something likened to the Garden of Eden with all of its resources and all of its all the graciousness of God in what he placed there. Where is this located? It says it is to the east in Eden. The obvious question is east of what? Makes a difference. Presumably, if we look through Genesis, it seems to be that Genesis is very Palestine-oriented. You might think about that as we march through Genesis. The extent to which it is Palestine-oriented. Almost everything is related to the Promised Land, to Palestine. And it would make sense that even here early in the book, that when it says to the east, it's to the east of Palestine. And that's a curious feature that we'll have to take into account. In a not too old recent of biblical archaeological review, a magazine that I subscribe to, they've done some satellite imaging of the ancient Near East and have discovered an old riverbed that flows from the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates. It flows, which direction would it be? It would be southeast. West, right through Saudi Arabia. And that the existence of a dry riverbed there had never been known before. But with the wonders of satellite imaging, they were able to detect that. And the author of this article was speculating that this was the Pishon. If that's true, then we do have three rivers, the Tigris, Euphrates, and this other river that do come together at what is now the top of the Persian Gulf. Now, having said that, I don't know what weight to put on that, because I do subscribe to the Biblical Archaeological Review, and I do read the articles sometimes. And if you read the articles, it's kind of like reading, the New England Journal of Medicine, where they'll say 1 month, don't eat salt, it'll kill you. And the next month they tell you, eat salt, otherwise you'll die. Well, finding the Garden of Eden is a similar kind of thing as with other archaeological discoveries. It may change next month, but in any case, that's a possibility. Man was placed there to work the ground and to take care of it. So God gave man a responsibility, something, a task that he was to do there. And there's a sense in which that was a privilege. He was being given something very meaningful for God, by God, for him to do in that garden. And he was given one, however, he was given one restriction. I want to reread this verse. This verse is going to become very important when we look at chapter 3. What God said to him was, "From any tree of the garden you may eat freely, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat from it you shall surely die." So it's a reference back to one of the trees that he mentioned by name, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He says, you can eat from any other tree, but don't eat from that one or you will die. So there's one restriction on what Adam can do here in the garden. Otherwise, he's got the run of the place, and he's the one who is there to work it and to keep it. That's his responsibility and his privilege. Now, in verse 18, God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone." This is a curious little episode here. This is the first interaction that God has with man. He looks at man and he says, "It is not good for him to be alone." God knows that. God made man. God made man with this lack. How does God deal with this lack? He gives him a biology assignment. It is so godlike. What he decides to do is have Adam discover what this lack is. And he does it by telling Adam to name all of the animals. God is going to bring the animals to him, and he is supposed to name them. Presumably in naming them, as was the wont in Hebrew culture, the name is supposed to capture the essence of something. You don't name them arbitrarily, but rather you try to name them appropriately. What name would be appropriate for this creature? So what God is asking Adam to do is to examine all of these creatures that God has made and to try to determine what the essence of that animal is and name it accordingly or appropriately. Adam does so. And in doing so, it's not hard to imagine what he would have learned. He would have learned two things, or two obvious things that he would have learned. One is, Adam was one of a kind. Of all the animals out there, none of them were like him. There were animals that had similar features, for sure. But there was no animal that was like him. The second thing is, all of the other animals came in matched pairs, male and female. He alone did not come in a match set. So through this biology lesson, Adam would come to the understanding, the realization, that he got shortchanged, that he was lacking a companion like all of the other animals had that was of the same kind as him. I think it's amazing that God's first interaction with man is to give him a biology lesson. Rather, God could have just said, you know, what you need is a woman. And Adam go, yeah, okay. But he didn't do it that way because he wanted Adam to learn that he needed a woman. At Gutenberg College, we have a course called A Survey of Western Civilization. And in 2 years, we survey the whole course of Western civilization, including all different disciplines, art, literature, philosophy, theology, history, science, etc. It's all rolled into one course. When we first started the course, we had 5 lectures per week on different aspects of Western civilization. And those of us who were teaching were not entirely satisfied with how the class how effective the class was. The students were not retaining as much as we had hoped that they would. So we began to talk about how could we make this a more effective class. And we met with a tutor from St. John's in Annapolis, Eva Brand, who met with our faculty. And we were talking about various, they have a great books program, which is similar to ours at Gutenberg. So we started talking about various aspects of our program and their program and comparing them and gaining from their wisdom and experience because they have been at this much longer than we have. And in the course of our discussion, she made kind of an offhand statement saying that lectures are not a very effective means of education. Well, when you think about it, that's so very, very true. We don't learn much from lectures. And what she was advocating was more discussions. Why do discussions work better than lectures? It's because someone who is actively engaged with the material learns a lot better than someone who is passively engaged with the material. In a lecture, you are passively engaged with the material. In a discussion, you are actively engaged with the material. It really seems to be the case that with human beings, we learn better when we are active learners. We learn better when we discover for ourselves rather than having something discovered for us. God seems to have taken this into account. So instead of telling Adam what the problem was, he gave Adam a project which forced him to be an active learner and a discoverer. It took longer. It probably took several, I don't know how long it took him. I don't know whether it took him days or whether it took him weeks or whether it took him years. If it was me, it would have been on the years side. But in any case, it must have taken time in order for him to observe the animals and deduce what is the essence of this creature and give it an appropriate name. So it would have been much faster if God had just told him, but far more effective for him to have discovered it himself. Adam started out with just some kind of vague feeling that something wasn't right. But Adam probably couldn't put his finger on what that feeling indicated. It wasn't until he had been through this process that this process would have triggered his thinking, I know what that feeling is now. I know what the problem is. And it wasn't until he reached that point that God acts to meet that need. So godlike that our lives are essentially one lesson after another of active learning, hands-on experience, living life, struggling with various kinds of issues, and God teaching us through those circumstances more about ourselves. They are far more effective than lectures. And I think we all recognize that. We all understand that. Some time ago, I was trying to put my files in order in my study, which is a major chore, and I do it as rarely as possible, and you can tell. But I had occasion to read back through some of my notes from over 20 years ago of lectures that I had given in teaching the Bible. And it's kind of haunting to do such a thing. But I was struck by two things. The first was how little in those notes I would change were I to teach it now. That's one thing. The second thing is how much better I understand that now than I did then. That I would have taught essentially the same thing, but my depth of understanding has changed dramatically. Now I'd know what I was talking about some of those times. And back then I didn't. And the reason I would know what I was talking about now is because I've had 20 years of private lessons in between then and now. And some of those lessons have been very repetitive. It's the same thing. The same issues keep coming up, and God pounding away on them. Clearly, there are areas in which I am learning challenged. That there are some things that just come hard, some lessons I don't learn easily, and God keeps pounding on them. There are other things that I learned, I think, relatively quickly. It didn't take too many lessons. But God knows the curriculum. He knows what I have to learn, and he knows what it takes for me to learn those things. And he keeps sending life towards me at the right pace, the right kinds of issues, the right kinds of circumstances. I mentioned in chapter 1 that it is curious that God spent 6 days to create the universe. He could have done it much more quickly. But God seems to like processes. He likes long, drawn-out lessons. And some of those lessons can get very long and drawn-out and tiresome, and yet God knows what he's doing. And it's through those processes that we will learn things that we could never learn through a lecture. In fact, most lectures just shed light on the experience that we have had. That's been my experience. Okay, so after he has made man aware of what the problem is, and only after he has made him aware of it does he move in and do something about it. God makes the woman. He performs an operation on man in order to do so. He puts him into a deep sleep. He's the first anesthesiologist. It is curious that he puts him to sleep. Why does he put him to sleep? This is reassuring to me, because much of my experience of God is, at least the stuff that I remember most vividly, is pain inflicted. That God is the one who inflicts pain on me. But notice here, there was pain involved, but he put Adam to sleep. God may inflict pain, but he's not a masochist. He doesn't inflict pain needlessly. And in this case, he put Adam to sleep to spare Adam knowledge of the pain that he was experiencing. There are other times in our lives when pain is inflicted and we are not put to sleep. We really feel it. We experience it. But rest assured, it's not because God's a masochist. It's not because he likes to see us squirm. It's because the pain is necessary to get our attention, to teach us the lesson that he wants to teach us. So he removes, while Adam is asleep, he removes from Adam the rib. And he fashions from the rib the woman. Why a rib? Other people have commented on this. I think it's probably right. One is, it is close to his vitals. So Eve is created out of something intimate, something close to Adam's essence. And Eve is made from the same stuff. It's the exact same stuff. She is just as much a human being as man is. So God fashions from this rib then Eve, and then he brings Eve to man, and his response is, that's it. After having looked at all of the animals, now when Eve comes to him, it's obvious to him not only that she is his pair, but she's exactly what he felt a need for, felt a lack of. She exactly meets the need that God had built into man right from the beginning. So she then is the suitable companion, the suitable helpmate that Adam was lacking and that God was going to fulfill. Now, there are some implications from this that I think are worth paying attention to. A few years ago, there was much talk about how people were arguing there is no inherent difference between males and females, that the differences that we see are the result of socialization rather than built into us. I have heard less talk about that in more recent years. And I suspect that the reason for that is because of the experiments that I have heard about that were conducted by other people of approximately my age. And that is attempts by parents to raise their children, both male and female, exactly the same. And invariably, those experiments failed, in a sense. That is, after 10 years of, let's make it less, 8 years of treating their children, male and female, exactly the same, and trying not to make any differentiation on the basis of sex. You hand a stick to a girl, and you hand a stick to a boy, and they will do different things with it. That a girl is going to do something like see it as a doll, and the boy is going to see it as something like a gun or a knife. It doesn't matter how much you've tried to train them differently, they are going to have those kinds of inclinations. And I don't know how many times I have talked to parents who have tried to conduct those kinds of experiments and have decided that it didn't work, that there are just boys and girls are different. And it's not socialization. They're born that way. It is almost humorous how consistently when we've had occasion to talk to a number of soccer coaches, quite a number, and most of them are coaching as much soccer as they can. And virtually every one of them will say, I would rather coach girls than boys. And the reason they say that is they say girls are more coachable. That boys, when they get on the soccer field, they want to impress. And because they want to impress, it's very difficult to get them to do what you want them to do in order for the whole team to function properly. With girls, you don't have that same problem. However, they will point out with other girls you have other problems. It just seems to be the case that there are things built into us. We are different from birth. It's not socialization. It is the nature of us. That would make sense. If God made man to serve and keep, to work and keep the garden, if man was given the primary responsibility for that task, and the woman then was made to be a helpmate for him, it makes sense that God would make them appropriate to their role that he has given them. It would make sense then that it is foolishness to think that you could take a man and by an operation turn him into a woman or vice versa. That's a very shallow understanding of what it means to be male and female. Or to think that you could do the same change through therapy of some sort. It runs much deeper than that. We are male to the core, and we are female to the core. It's just built into it. It's all through us. What are the differences? That's difficult. To be able to actually list the differences between male and female, you can always find exceptions. So it's very difficult to come up with a list that's satisfactory. But does that mean that there are not differences built into us? I think not. I think that it's still possible and highly likely that there are differences that are built into us that run very, very deep. It makes sense then that we would accept the person that we are, whether it's male or female, however God made us, to come to an understanding of what that is and live that out accordingly, rather than shake our fist at God and ask him, why did you make me thus? This is not just true of whether we're male or female. It runs through all of our existence. Why did God make me an American rather than an Estonian? Why did God have me born to my parents rather than other parents? Why did God have me born in one socioeconomic position rather than another? You can go on and on and on. And the question is, are we going to accept that and learn to live out our lives in accordance with God's principles in whatever position he has placed us, or are we going to shake our fist at God and say, why have you made me thus? It is very important to remember that in the initial creation account in chapter 1, God made man in the image of himself, both male and female. In that respect, man and woman are no different. Both are equally capable of reflecting the character of God. And that ultimately is our primary purpose in life. The rest of our condition is mere happenstance. Then God instituted marriage. We have at least Moses has a commentary on this, on the creation of woman for man, and says, for this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So the institution of marriage as the fulfillment of, as the solution to man's loneliness. This is the kind of companionship that he wants and needs. This was what the desire that was built into him right from the beginning was, for this kind of companionship. He is to leave his mother and his father. They do not provide that kind of companionship. He's to leave his father and mother and become united with his wife, who does provide that kind of companionship. And there's a sense in which this is a reunion, in the sense that as Eve was taken from man, then in marriage they come back together. And then the comment at the last verse of the chapter, and the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. We will come back to that, obviously, in the next chapter. But here they are, naked and not aware of their nakedness. It is not a problem. They are not self-conscious. And there's no guilt. And that will change in the next chapter. This chapter is really setting up. It's important to understand this chapter in order to understand the next chapter. There are several places in this chapter that I've mentioned, we need to take particular note of it because it's going to be built on in the next chapter. But in general, what we see in this chapter is God's graciousness towards man, his generosity. He went to great pains to create a situation for man to live in that was well-suited to him. He was well-provided for. He was given a great deal of liberty. And he was given a privilege in the responsibility of taking care of the garden. Furthermore, God met his need for a companion. So everything we see in chapter 2 is indicative of God's graciousness and generosity towards man. In the next chapter, we're going to see all of that called into question. Questions or comments?
I don't mean to put you on the spot. I was interested in the she shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Mm-hmm. Have you had any thoughts on what exactly that sentence is asserting?
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, as I know you know, the word for woman looks much like the word for man, only with a feminine ending, and yet linguists say that that's not what it is. I think what we have here is similarity of words being used for literary effect. We see that elsewhere, where someone's name will be massaged a little bit to make a different point. No examples come to mind. I know you have pointed out a couple in the past, and I have pointed out a couple in the past. I think it's just it could be that it's just a linguistic accident that the two are similar. But the point that's being made is that they are of a piece. That the similarity in names points out that they are of the same stuff. So I think that's all that it's emphasizing, is that they are essentially the same stuff.
This is an argument I use against Gaia theorists, but also it does give me a little trouble here. We were made of the earth, modeled from the clay, made of the same stuff that everything else is made of. And yet, life seems to be really out to get me. Without an immune system, I'd be dead in hours. There's so much out there that is fatal to me. And yet apparently, and yet I'm told we're all made of the same stuff and come from the same place. Why am I so, and everything else so, incompatible with each other if we're all from the same place?
Well, that's a coin with two sides, because on the one hand, yes, there's a lot of incompatibility, but on the other hand, one could make the argument for how much harmony there is. The whole ecosystem is quite harmonious. That things are so interrelated, it's quite phenomenal. And we can either stress the conflict and tension that we see in nature, or we can stress the harmony, depending on what our purposes are. From the biblical perspective, both are there. That there's a great deal of harmony that God built into the universe, but there is a great deal of threat and danger as well. And that were it not for the activity of God restraining that threat and danger, it would swamp all of us. So they're both there. They're two sides of the same coin, I think. Margaret.
Just the other day in the news, I read of a situation where there was a young woman who always felt like a guy. I think she was in her middle to late teens when finally she approached her parents and said, "I've always felt like a guy. I want you to get me an operation so I can be a guy." And it was at that point that her parents told her that she had been born a boy, and that during a botched circumcision procedure, it had been decided the best way to deal with that was just to make her physically not a man, and raise her as a girl. And she was actually a boy. And at that point, they started some other kind of surgery to return him to his normal physiological state, and he's now married. And he something came up where he felt like it was important to talk about this. And I thought that was intriguing, especially since a couple of months ago I read a book called Brain Sex, where it talks about the process of people developing sexually in all respects, not only the external physical signs, but male and female brains are different, that when we're first conceived, we're actually sort of female by default, but then when male hormones start being produced, the brain starts becoming sexualized far before the external physical body is ready to be sexualized. The brain is being sexualized. And one of the things this book talked about was, probably everybody's familiar with the phenomenon of hermaphroditism, where you get both genders on the external genitalia, both male and female genitalia, because of a screw-up in hormones in the development of the child. And so it seems like the process of sexualization starts very, very early when sexual hormones start being produced and the brain starts becoming sexualized and everything goes fine. The brain becomes sexualized first, and then later the body bears the marks of one gender or the other. And this book was talking about there's no, because hermaphroditism does happen, there's no necessary reason to think that you couldn't have another kind of a screw-up, which is the brain becomes sexualized or not. The hormones have to be there in the right amounts at the right time for the right stage of the evolution to happen. And if the hormones are not there at that time, one stage might happen and the other stage not. For instance, if the hormones are there in the beginning when the brain is developing, the brain might become male, and then later, if there's inadequacy of hormones or exposure to other kinds of chemicals, the body would be female, or vice versa, the brain would be female and then the body would be male. And apparently it's modern environment, there are lots of chemicals around that especially mimic female hormones. And the book was suggesting that because you have many more men trying to be women rather than women trying to be men, that it may be these chemicals, they call them xenoestrogens, strange estrogens, very often pesticides and fertilizers and that kind of thing are xenoestrogens, that might account for the fact that the brain becomes does not become masculinized at the time that it ought to, but later on the body does become masculinized, so that you essentially have, whereas this first person I was talking about, his situation was a result of a human intervention, obviously human intervention, you might have a situation where someone, unbeknownst to anybody, his brain or her brain has been sexualized one way while her body looks another. And that might account for people who say, you know, I've always felt like a man or I've always felt like a female, even though my body looks like the opposite sex. Can you, I think that's interesting to me, because I don't know how I would tell, first of all, even if I knew that something like that had happened, that, say, there's a man whose brain was feminized, was not masculinized, the hormones were not available at the right time, but his body developed like a man. Even if I knew that was the case, I don't know what the right thing to tell this person to do is. And then it's complicated by the fact that we're such rebels that it's very easy for me to imagine someone whose brain is male, his body is male, and just out of sheer cussedness wants to be a female out of sheer rebellion. So I was just wondering, could you comment, let's say we knew for sure somebody's brain was female but their body was male, what would you think about a sex change operation for that individual? And then do you have any thoughts on how you would tell someone who was, the problem was fundamentally biological, from someone who the problem was fundamentally rebellion?
I don't know. But it is, I am very suspicious of science, is part of my problem, because I know too many scientists. And I know that science is more of an art than scientists would lead us to believe. And that as a result, what a scientist thinks has a huge impact on what a scientist finds. So I think it would be very, I think it's important to pursue some of these questions. I think it's good that research is done. But the research needs to be done, and people need to be checking up on the researchers. To what extent are their biases steering their findings? And then decisions with respect to treatment, I think, should be based on really sound, cautious appraisal of what the scientists have discovered. But we live in a time right now when the culture predisposes us to justify people wanting to have sex change operations.